ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As America marks 250 years of independence from Britain, join me, Nick Bryant, for an exploration of the country's origin story and what's happened since.
This is the beginning of the time when human beings were no longer subjects, but citizens.
From the Declaration of Independence to the presidency of Donald Trump, join me for our America 250 series on Saturday Extra. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. There was a time, not so long ago, when great European cities could more or less feed themselves with little gardens and horse droppings. Later in the show, we're looking at the fascinating history of city gardens, a history, some argue, puts in question the purpose of today's industrial farming. But first, in a week of anniversaries, here's another to celebrate. 30 years ago today, the Northern Territory became the first place in the world where doctors could help people die.
My resolve to promote the decriminalisation of voluntary euthanasia stems from the fact that despite searching for one, I have never found a rational argument for insisting that an individual continue to endure pain, indignity and suffering when they would prefer to die.
That's Marshall Perrin, long-time Chief Minister of the Territory, speaking a couple of months after his 1996 Rights of the Terminally Ill Act came into effect. It lasted only about another 6 months, the new Howard government quashing the law in March 1997. These days, every state in the country, plus the ACT, has laws allowing voluntary assisted dying, except, ironically, the Northern Territory. But legislation is due to be tabled there any day. To celebrate the anniversary of his pioneering work, we're joined by Marshall Perrin. Marshall, welcome to Late Night Live.
Good evening, David, and good evening to Territory listeners.
Tell us, what was the day like when you introduced the bill to the Darwin Parliament in February 1995?
Well, it was a very important day for me, of course, because I had spent some weeks polishing and the arguments I needed to run a case that had not been run before, basically anywhere in Australia, certainly, but to some degree around the world. And that is the suggestion that one individual would be permitted to assist and take the life of another, both being consenting adults. And so it was a polished piece of legislation. I'd prepared a strategy that I hoped would answer every question that could be asked from the onslaught that I expected would be coming and did come. And I'm pleased to say that the homework that I had done with a couple of assistants in identifying issues that needed to be addressed, including what happens with wills and insurance and all sorts of things like that when someone opted to die, were covered, and we had answers for them all. So, yeah, it was a very important day for me, and the end of a very long, long career as well in politics.
So the bill was introduced in February, and then sort of the real debate came a few months later in May. Those months in between, what was that like? Who were you finding pushback from?
Well, David, it was amazing that it was a bit like I had scratched society and it started to bleed. I and my colleagues were inundated with letters from people who told these terrible stories about how they'd assisted someone to die in their family or had witnessed suffering, which was absolutely unbearable as one loved one's died, and that they'd kept these stories bottled up in the family for years.
Yeah,
and so I and my colleagues were inundated by letters from all over Australia and some from internationally about what I was trying to do, and most all of them were in support of what I was trying to do.
But you had no support from the Australian Medical Association.
No. In fact, there was a coalition of religious organisations and the AMA. They were desperate to stop the first law ever being introduced or ever passing, because they rightly believed that if it was successful, other jurisdictions would follow and the genie would be out of the bottle. So they were desperate to have this stopped right in its tracks in the Northern Territory. And having lost the parliamentary debate, this is after the bill passed, of course, they challenged the validity of the law, lost the case, appealed to the High Court, then appealed to Prime Minister Keating to have the Governor-General overturn the legislation. And then the story goes. So,
but Marshall, why? What was the worry of the, firstly, of the Australian Medical Association?
Well, the Australian Medical Association took the view that these issues were not to be dealt with by other than doctors. All power rests with doctors in the absence of VAD, which gives the right of, as my legislation was titled, the rights of the terminally ill. And my legislation was actually giving the terminally ill, competent adult, the authority to seek a cooperative doctor to take their own life. Now, that was completely contrary to what the AMA wanted. They said that doctors were not going to relinquish their authority over advising patients as to what's in their best interests. And they fought the campaign across Australia with most all of the legislation that was imposed over the years, and gradually came around to moving to a position of neutrality eventually, and now they're actually supportive of VAD.
But let's go back to this time.
Yes.
We kind of all know that the church would object to this kind of thing, but why do religious bodies object to this? What is the violation of Christ's law in helping somebody die?
Well, I guess I have trouble understanding it, David, myself. However, as has been put to me on many occasions and submitted to parliamentary inquiries as well, and that is that the religious organisations or the hierarchy of religious organisations believe that only God can give life and only God can take it. Now, that view is very strongly held by people who are deeply, deeply religious. However, interestingly enough, polls have shown that the rank and file churchgoer and religious person who identifies as religious, in fact, a majority of them support having the option of voluntary assisted dying. So it's the hierarchy of the churches, not the rank and file of churches, who actually oppose voluntary euthanasia.
Marshall, when the legislation was introduced to the Darwin Parliament in May 1995, did you expect it would pass?
I was completely unsure. But, David, what I believed, that even if it failed, the fact that we were having the debate would probably advance the day when someone else would pick up the cudgels and try and move it forward again. So, to me, there was no downside to me introducing the legislation, even though I had been counselled by a number of friends saying, "What have you done? You've blemished an otherwise reasonable political career by treading down this path where no one has formally gone." But I didn't see it that way at all. I just felt it was the right thing to do. And if I was going to try and do anything significant in this respect, it would have to be obviously while I was in Parliament, not after I had retired and stood on a street corner advocating it. When I had the opportunity, I should do it.
You've mentioned before that various appeals were taken to courts, but the legislation survived all that and operated for how long?
Precisely 9 months from when it was first commenced, and that was the 1st of July 96, that is 30 years today. But it was first used in the 22nd of August by Bob Dent, the Darwin man. So it was 53 days after the legislation had come into operational.
Tell us Bob Dent's story.
Bob Dent was a man who had multiple ailments, including prostate cancer. He had been treated and in palliative care over a long period of time, and was in his life was a complete misery. And he was a strong advocate and a classic example of why the law should be in place. And he managed to contact Dr. Philip Nitschke, who was the one doctor in the territory at the time who was prepared to use the legislation and operate within it. However, it was a torturous process for Dr. Philip Nitschke, because the AMA, as soon as the law had been passed, determined that they were going to do everything in their power to stop it ever being used. And they instructed doctors across the territory that if the legislation was found to be invalid in due course by court cases, that any doctor who operated within the period after it came into operation would face legal jeopardy. And that's completely outrageous, of course, because if everyone believed the law was valid and you acted within it, then there was no way a subsequent invalid finding was going to place any doctor at risk. However, the AMA campaign was successful in having doctors who are conservative by nature anyway, avoiding cooperating with Philip Nitschke to provide a second opinion as to the prognosis for an applicant for VAD.
So how many opinions did you need to have? What did Bob Dent need to have before Nitschke would operate?
Assist him. He had to have two doctors, one a specialist in the disease, confirm what the diagnosis and prognosis was for Bob Dent. He also had to have a psychiatric examination by a psychiatrist to determine that he was competent. And that proved difficult, because I think there was only one or two psychiatrists in the Northern Territory. But Philip Nitschke had a great deal of difficulty getting doctors to cooperate.
The family of the 66-year-old Darwin man, who became the first person to die under the Northern Territory's euthanasia law, is now preparing for a private funeral ceremony amidst enormous public attention. Dr. Philip Nitschke, the doctor who assisted in the death, today described the emotions of the event last weekend, including a last letter dictated by his patient.
I ended up feeling extremely good about what I did, something which I feel I would certainly do again, and believe it was an entirely appropriate thing to do. And a lot of that was because of, if you like, the encouragement given to me by this thoughtful, brave man. The patient, in an attempt to reassure my anxieties on the day he chose, restated the fact that he believed that this was an ultimate act of love, what he had asked me to do.
Dr. Philip Nitschke, the first doctor to administer a legal lethal injection to a patient. That patient was Darwin man Bob Dent.
So Bob Dent fulfilled all of the obligations, and Nitschke, who became known as Dr. Death, eased him on his way. How many people actually were able to take to make use of the law before Canberra quashed it?
During the 9-month period that the law was on foot, 4 people used the law to die, all assisted by Dr. Philip Nitschke, all of them taking their own lives by activating a machine that was connected intravenously to the patient, who had to operate the process themselves. So Dr. Nitschke actually didn't use what was allowed under the legislation, and that is for a doctor to actually assist the patient by direct injection, for example. But Philip had a machine developed whereby a patient was connected intravenously to a syringe and activated the process to die themselves.
The most famous story, because it became celebrated on the stage and film, was about a taxi driver from Boken Hill called Max Bell. Now, he didn't succeed in dying. What happened to him?
Max Bell was the first person who should have accessed the legislation. He came to Darwin just before the 1st of July 1996 in the hope. He drove himself from Broken Hill to Darwin in a terrible state physically, and he hoped to use the law to die peacefully. Dr. Philip Netsky tried to get a second doctor to examine Max, who also was suffering advanced stages of cancer, and he could not find a single doctor anywhere in the territory who would even see Max to confirm his diagnosis. And after some weeks, Max Bell got so frustrated with the process and decided that he had to go back to Broken Hill to die, which he did, and he died a terrible death, the sort of death that he was so desperate to avoid, was his fate in a hospital in Broken Hill.
A story, I wouldn't say celebrated, but in the film Last Cab to Darwin.
Yes, but unfortunately the film Last Cab to Darwin was about as far away from the reality as it could get.
Film can be like that, Marshall.
Well, it is, and it was dramatised, and it was a distorted view of what really happened to Max. What it was, however, recorded, I'm pleased to say, by the ABC, Murray McLaughlin and the ABC.
It was as much grit as organisation which got Max Bell on the road to Darwin. A former taxi driver, he made the 3,100-kilometre drive from Broken Hill in 6 days.
He set out in what would have to be described as a critically ill situation, a person who is unable to eat, a person who has extreme pain.
I just sat there and I, a lot of time fighting nausea all the time and I'm drinking, sipping water. I didn't eat much, a bit of soup, maybe the most. I knocked myself a bit, more than I probably realised. I got the job done.
And he did it because it seemed to me he was driven by one thing, and that was the goal, and the goal was to get to Darwin. Darwin had been become this kind of place, this destination, this journey, the most important journey of his life.
I'm not living, it's just existing. And I don't see the point. I don't see the point why we should have to.
Well, what they are saying is that these days there's this thing called palliative care.
Yeah.
And that they can manage the pain and they can get you through.
Fill you up with pills. And give you morphine. Is that living? Would you say that was an alternative to have a nice, sweet, long sleep? Of course it's not.
And the taxi?
The taxi was eventually gifted to Philip Netsky in Max's will, and Philip Netsky has donated it, I understand, to the Northern Territory Museum.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm talking to Marshall Perrin about the short-lived voluntary-assisted dying legislation that he introduced to the Northern Territory 30 years ago this week. Marshall, it became pretty clear to you once the Howard government won the 1996 election that they were going to do what they could to kill the legislation. Who was leading the charge in the Howard government?
Well, as I understand it from certain sources, it was John Howard who actually mentioned in the party room that anyone who wanted to do something about what the territory was happening, what was happening in the territory, should feel free to do so. And the person who took up that invitation was Kevin Andrews, the member for Menzies in Victoria, a very stoutly religious man, who took the unusual step of introducing a private member's bill in federal parliament. So it wasn't the actual Australian government that vetoed the Northern Territory's law. It was the Australian parliament via a private member's bill. Now, that private member's bill got a dream run through the federal parliament by the Howard government, facilitating its passage and debate. Because normally a private member's bill in federal parliament goes nowhere. They are often introduced, but they are normally just sit on the notice paper and disappear at the following election.
Yeah.
But this one was given a dream run.
Labor members support it?
It was supported on both sides of parliament. It was a conscience vote, which is, and it should have been as well. But what the, unfortunately, the debate was all about voluntary euthanasia at the time, when in fact the principle of being, that was being debated, in fact, was overturning another democratically elected parliament, because the Northern Territory Parliament was completely legitimate, had acted within its powers as a democratically elected parliament to pass such a law.
But the Constitution does allow the federal government to override the legislatures of the territories, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So there was no suggestion that the Kevin Andrews legislation was in any sense illegal or invalid. It was a valid course, but having passed the Territory Parliament, having survived court cases, having survived an application to the Governor General, you would have thought the law should stand. But no, the federal parliament came in with a heavy hand and took the unprecedented step of overturning another democratically elected parliament. The Northern Territory Parliament actually issued a remonstrance, which most of your listeners have probably never heard of.
I like the sound of it.
A remonstrance is an act passed by a parliament as a protest to another parliament, a more superior parliament. And it's the highest form of protest that you can get in the parliamentary process, the Westminster parliamentary process. And the remonstrance was delivered, passed unanimously by the Northern Territory Legislative Assembly before the Kevin Andrews legislation was passed, protesting about it and asking for it to be not proceeded with. And it was tabled in both houses of federal parliament, but completely ignored.
Did this experience make the federal parliament, federal governments, more reluctant, more careful to override territory legislation?
Well, interestingly, many years later, even though the Northern Territory Self-Government Act, when the territory's voluntary euthanasia legislation was on foot, the Self-Government Act had a clause in it which allowed the Governor General to overturn any territory legislation that was passed within 6 months of its passage through the Legislative Assembly. And that was the application that was made to Prime Minister Keating just before Howard was elected, and asking him to refer it to the Governor General under that section of the Northern Territory Self-Government Act. And to his credit, Paul Keating declined to take that request to the Governor General on the basis that voluntary euthanasia, in his opinion, was a matter for the territory to decide. So that was the time when we thought that all possible legal challenges to the law had been exhausted. We never suspected that a private member's bill would come out of the blue, as it did eventually when after John Howard was elected.
You didn't realise how cunning John Howard could be.
Well, obviously, he's a man of strong opinion, but he was prepared to disregard the principles of parliamentary democracy because it didn't suit his religious belief.
Now, Marshall, since then, since all this disappointment and kerfuffle, every state and territory in Australia, except the Northern Territory, has voluntary assisted dying legislation. Now, why, with the phenomenal start up in the north, what's happened? Why isn't it there?
Well, during that period of time, the Territory Parliament didn't have the authority, of course, to repass the legislation, neither did the ACT.
Oh, of course, because that had been removed by the Canberra legislation.
Yes, right. They not only overturned the Northern Territory's Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, they withdrew from the Territory Parliament and the ACT the authority to process such legislation ever again.
Yep.
So from 1997 to 2022, neither the Territory nor the ACT had the authority. But that was 4 years ago now, and it's been 4 years of procrastination in the Northern Territory for them to get around to actually doing something on this issue. To their credit, the ACT moved very quickly after they had the authority to do so, returned to them, and they now have a law that is the most progressive law in Australia and is currently in operation in the ACT.
But in the Northern Territory, there's some promise of legislation. How definite's that promise?
Well, the Chief Minister has in recent days promised that the government will introduce a bill and allow a conscience vote in the Territory Parliament in July or August this year. And so we're hoping that that to be the case. It's taken them 4 years to get to this point, which is just disgraceful, because during that period, of course, there have been Territorians who would have used the legislation had it passed, as the ACT has done, who have been died the sort of death that we all fear.
Where's Dr. Nitschke these days?
Dr. Nitschke, I understand, resides in the Netherlands these days. He was stripped of his doctor's powers by the Medical Registration Board of Australia, and he decided that he was going to relocate to Europe and continue his passion of running the organisation called Exit International, which is a voluntary euthanasia advocacy group that is worldwide. He makes regular visits to Australia and holds workshops in all states arguing the case.
And where are you these days at the sprightly age of, what, about 84?
84, yes. It's been a long time since I passed this legislation 30 years ago. I now reside in the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. My wife and I decided after over 50 years in Darwin that we needed to move to cooler climates for our retirement.
Yeah, bitterly cold.
Well, mate, bitterly cold to me. If it gets below 20 degrees, I'm cold. And it gets to below 20 degrees every night at the moment.
Ah, it's grim. But I admire, Marshall, the way you're hanging on in there on the Sunshine Coast at what I don't take to be a particularly old age, 84. It's just over the horizon. Thank you for coming on Late Night Live. This is a mighty anniversary to celebrate.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, David. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words on the subject.
Coming up, when cities fed themselves. With a third of the world's fertiliser trapped in the Strait of Hormuz, fertiliser made from natural gas, and global food supplies in peril, it's time to celebrate the old ways we had and still have of growing our food. What follows, ladies and gentlemen, is a hymn to gardens and shit. Kate Brown, distinguished professor in the history of science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has written Tiny Gardens Everywhere, A History of City Gardens and Their Role in Feeding Us, Then and Now and to Come. Kate, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks, David, for having me on your show. I'm excited to be virtually in Australia.
Tell us about the role and the importance of horse shit in Paris.
Well, I mean, here's the amazing thing, right? Just as cities started to get really big, you know, Paris, Berlin, London, New York, working people came into the cities from the countryside. Everybody had been rural before the mid-19th century, and they had a sense of what to do with wastes. They had a sense of that land should be used, and they had a sense of commons and common rights, and common rights were the rights to food, fuel, and shelter. So, you know, people came, in the Marais district of Paris, which is now a really posh neighborhood. At the time was a poor working class Jewish neighborhood, and it was pretty swampy. And people started to use the city infrastructure to grow food, because that's something that migrants to cities do. They're usually the ones who grow food in and around cities. And so these Jewish working class people went inside courtyards, and because inside courtyards it was warmer, blocked the wind, trapped the sun, and they started growing, you know, spring crops in the winter and summer crops in the spring. And they did that by taking horse manure. And there's, you know, this is the time when horses were plodding around the city and there was just piles of horse manure everywhere available for pennies on the pound. And these farmers, you know, got them from the stable boys. They would use the horse manure first, before they composted into delicious soils, they would first use it for its heat. They would bury about 2 feet thick of horse manure under the ground. They'd put some topsoil on top, put seeds in the ground, and then some windows over it. And this was like a, they called them hotbeds, and these were basically little greenhouses heated by the sun above and the warming microbes from below.
And this is the origin of the expression hotbed.
That's right. A hotbed of dissent, right?
A hotbed of dissent, a hotbed of crime, a hotbed of, yes.
Yes, exactly that. And so this was an amazing resource. So the gardeners, you know, like grew all this food. They could beat, because they used this heat, and, you know, they used the heat of walls in the city. You know, they're thinking of the city as a technology, as an infrastructure for farming. And so they have 300 kilometers of what they call wall orchards, where they would, you know, espalier fruit trees onto the southwest facing walls. The walls block the wind, the walls preserve the sun, and you could have apricots and peaches and plums ripen at the same time they did in the south of France. And so these urban gardeners could beat the Mediterranean farmers to the Parisian market, to the Parisian markets, and undersell them, you know, have it at a lower price, because they just had to cart them over to the local, you know, town markets. So one of the big things that these farmers sold was composted horse manure. They had too much of it. They would sell it to farmers outside the city who were working these exhausted, worn out soils. And so I think that's what one of the first messages of this book, Tiny Gardens Everywhere, is that cities are fantastic places to grow food, because they collect humans, lots of humans in one place, collect this river Nile of organic nutrients, whether they're sugar beets from Ukraine, wheat from the American West, beef from Argentina. Farmers, commoners knew how to take all those organic nutrients, heat them up in composted piles, and turn them into really rich soils to grow food that are ever renewing. No need for artificial fertilizers. No need. In the 19th century, they were importing, they were fighting wars to get as much guano as they could off the coast of Chile in South America. No need to do that. No need for farmers to be poor just to fertilize their fields.
Kate, did it survive to the second generation? I mean, the first generation comes in from the farms. They know exactly what to do. Does that knowledge and the investment of time and energy then go down into the next generations?
Yeah, this system worked for a good 50, 60 years. Paris produced the fruits and vegetables that 5,000 farmers, urban farmers, produced the fruits and vegetables that 2 million Parisians ate, with a surplus to go to London. What doomed it was the arrival of the automobile.
The internal combustion engine.
Yeah.
So what happens then?
Well, then, you know, Paris starts to do what we do. They started to import their food from other places. People started to pay higher prices. And a lot of waste started to be dumped in waterways. You know, the Seine is just getting clean enough now to swim in again.
Yes, that's right, after a huge
one
effort.
One thing that the Parisians did do is that, the horses are gone, but they still have a lot of big mammals in the city. And those mammals are humans. And those humans have to relieve themselves once a day, probably, or if not more. And they started bringing that to the edge of the city. This is before flush toilets. And started making a product called poudre, which was a composted, dried human manure that farmers bought avidly until the onset of the flush toilet.
So first the internal combustion engine, then the flush toilet.
Right.
But
right.
At what point did people living in the cities start getting allotments of land on the edges of cities? This is something we don't see in Australia, but when we get to Europe, we see it everywhere, the allotments.
Exactly. Yeah, there's two different strains. Some allotments were, the first ones occurred in England, And in England, you know, we famously know about the Parliamentary Acts of Enclosure that began in the beginning of the, you know, like 1800, they really started to go, 1750 to 1850, 6 million acres of land was enclosed in England. And that meant that people who used common land, both pastures and forests and swamps and hedges that were just edible pantries, those people could no longer afford to live and farm. And so they go into cities and they or they wander the rural roads looking for jobs as farmhands. And there were so many people, so many homeless people, hungry people, you know, the Dickens scene that we know, that the poor tax started to get really high and the landowners started to resent having to pay welfare for the poor. And so they said, you know what? Why don't we give them a little bit of land? Not enough so that they can feed themselves, because if they can feed themselves, they won't work for us. But just enough so they can get by between jobs during hard times. And maybe, you know, the old folks and the women and children can do that gardening work. So that's the beginning of allotments. They calculated with you know, great cruelty, really, just how small those allotments should be so that a family could not provide for itself. So in exchange for a parish might have had 2,000 acres in common land, the parishioners, you know, the commoners now get 20 acres, you know, poor compensation for what was lost. But in places like Berlin and on the outskirts of places like London, some people started to create their own allotment gardens. These were sort of worker, not you know, sort of paternalistic, but worker-driven allotment gardens. And Berlin in the 1870s, about 30 or 40 working class households would get together and they would rent what would become a Berlin city block. And they would divide up this block into exactly equal proportions. And everybody would put a tiny house in the middle of their lot. And all around it, they would garden. And they would get some chickens, certainly, and maybe a pig or two. And they would dig wells together. And pretty soon their lives got a lot easier. They could grow their own food. They could build their own little house. That meant they could easily pay the rent on this land. And then, you know, it got real. And they used whatever the city served up, you know, beer mash from the breweries, you know, pulp from the sugar beet factories, their own food scraps, their own night soil, that of their chickens and their pigs. And they produced, again, just like the Parisian farmers, fantastic human engineered soils that grew really well. And if you watch the YouTube version of this, you'll see some of these photographs of these really lush places.
Yes.
But then, you know, people start to do, you know, so now they have this, what we would call like a social infrastructure, this garden community, and they would elect a council to rule themselves, and that council would elect a president. And then they'd say, you know, we have some other problems. Like the kids don't have anything to do all summer. They're running wild. So they would start a children's summer camp. And they'd say, some people are coming down with tuberculosis, so let's build a little shed over there. We'll make a sanatorium. Or some people's huts burned down. Let's take up a collection for fire insurance and maybe another one to compensate workers who are out of work because of an injury or they were laid off. So we know that Germany was the first place in the world to come up with a social security, you know, welfare state.
From the gardens.
But we always attribute it to this guy named Otto von Bismarck.
This guy, yes. Yeah, we've heard of him.
But 10 years before that, these gardeners were working out, not in laws or policies, but with their hands, with their voices in community, in these mutual aid societies, they were working out the first sinews of the welfare state.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Kate Brown about gardens. Tiny gardens. And Kate, one of the fascinating things in your book is the contest between, in Soviet Russia, in the contest between collectivized farms and little gardens. And it became a huge contest.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so this is the history we know of the Soviet Union, is that in 1928, Stalin ordered that all Soviet farms be collectivized. Everybody, again, we have these commoners living in villages, having land they shared in common, fields that they worked in common. And the state ordered that they basically big mega farms to be created, you know, the first kind of industrial agriculture, you know, a farm of 5,000 acres and many employees. And we know that these farms failed. There was a famine 3 years after the beginning of collectivization, where 5 to 7 million people died of hunger. But here's the story we don't really know, is that in 1933, right, you know, in the midst of this famine, the state did what Germany, the first Weimar, the first Republic in Germany had done after the monarch, the Kaiser, was gone after World War I. They gave people the right to garden. That meant they were given public land to privately self-provision. So all around every Soviet city and post-Soviet city today, there's a green belt of allotment gardens. And people, again, formed garden associations. More people were members of garden associations in the Soviet Union than members of the Communist Party. It's by far the biggest social movement in that country. And every time there was a food crisis, World War II, the state said, everybody's on their own. We're only feeding the army. Everybody has to grow their own food. And they gave out more land. And people went out and they grew their own food. When I was living in the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and people talked about a famine. Collective farm production dropped in half in 1992. But there was no famine. And that's because, the state doubled down. Everybody here takes some more land. People went out, they took the trolley or the bus to the edge of the city, and they started growing yet more food. They already had been. By the 1980s, they grew about 60% of the food people ate. By the mid-1990s, 91% of the potatoes people ate, and of course, potatoes are a staple in Russia, were grown on tiny allotment gardens on 1.5% of the arable land in the country. So when we hear, you know, pundits talk about, well, without big agriculture, you know, conventional agriculture, how could we feed 9 billion people on Earth? This gives us pause. We don't maybe need all that land. It's a terribly inefficient, energy intensive and expensive way to produce food that's channeled through a lot of animals' bodies before it really comes onto our plates for our meals. And here were these Soviet citizens in a big industrialized country feeding themselves. With small plots of land just outside the city.
But, Kate, it depends on the crop, doesn't it? Yes, potatoes in small allotments, but wheat? That needs broad acres, doesn't it?
Sure, wheat needs broad acres. Do we need to eat a lot of bread? There is a chef of the world's best vegan restaurant in the Netherlands, and he's been making bread flour out of chestnuts. Because it's really easy to grow chestnuts in the Netherlands. And his chestnut flour bread is delicious and full of protein. Now, how did we get addicted to wheat in the first place? Because it was easy to tax and it was easy to cart and store. But not necessarily because it's the best food.
Yeah, but you can make it in gigantic quantities. And there are a lot of people on Earth to feed.
Yeah, and you know, and here's Russia, a wheat-growing country. But yet people eat potatoes most of their meals in the day. In other places, of course, it's rice, and rice is often grown in small batches. So, I mean, I think that's an interesting thing, and there are people who are trying to tackle this food issue. Like, how can we change our diets in exciting and interesting ways that's more sustainable for the planet and more sustainable and healthy for our bodies? A good part of the corn, and here I'm talking about, you know, like field corn, maize, and soybeans that are grown in the American West in our big agricultural belt is not fed to humans directly, but is fed to animals, often animals in China, animals in Denmark. And then it's turned finally into food for humans, but only about a tenth of that energy, of those calories, is actually goes into our food. The rest is wasted as it's digested through animals.
Now, Kate, you took us to the Netherlands a moment ago, and that takes us to the contest over the use of human shit, because you note in the book that it's still illegal to do that in the Netherlands. Am I right?
That's right.
So
that's right.
What are the uses of human shit? Is it as useful as horse shit.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's better. Everything that the plants humans eat, the minerals that are in the plants humans eat, also happen, of course, to be in our poop, because those are the plants we eat. And so we have this really nice cycle that we can cycle through. And that's what people did for millennia, is use their night soil to fertilize their fields and grow food and in a really nice metabolic cycle without a lot of waste. China is just having its toilet revolution right now. They've had outhouses, especially in rural places, until today. And people have lawsuits over who gets to use what's in those outhouses.
But shit.
So it's a shit, human shit. So what's the problem with human shit? It's toilets.
Yes.
We add water.
Right.
We just adding clean water to our human shit makes a big problem. Because when you add water, you keep those microbes alive, especially the pathogenic ones, and you can spread disease. And that's what happened in London, you know, one of the first cities to plug into toilets. They just dumped the sewer water right in the Thames, and they created a lot of disease and a lot of other environmental problems. If you don't add water and you just have a dry composting toilet and you take your poop and you put it somewhere and add other, add carbon, you know, wood chips or hay or straw, it breaks down into soil. And that is a fantastic resource. And so there's some artists in Amsterdam, Fidelis Lapidus is one, and she has this whole give a shit campaign. She's like, you know, when I realized that to help the world, to help the environment, all I had to do was take a dump and then do something productive with it, I suddenly started to feel really happy. So she has a horse trailer that she and her partner have hooked up. And one end of the horse trailer is a toilet that they cart around to festivals. And then the other end is a sandwich shop. And so if you donate, if you give a shit, then you get this discounted sandwich that's made with vegetables that were grown in composted human fertilizer.
But Kate, human fertilizer carries an awful, these days, the modern human person fertilizer carries all sorts of toxic problems, doesn't it?
Well, it is when you get it through the sewage streams, right? So when we flush our toilets, our water and our poop and our urine goes along with all kinds of things that comes off the streets, with all kinds of pipes that come from factories, and they all end up at the treatment facility. And the treatment facility spends a ton of resources and energy separating back out that now dirty water that used to be clean before you flush your toilet from the poop and other solid matter. And so now we have, and we do this in the United States, you know, farmers can buy from waste treatment plants fertilizers. They're very affordable, made from human poop. But the problem is, and you probably have eaten lots of human, you know, human ore food. But the problem with that is that running through those sewage systems, is there's all kinds of toxins in those systems. There's PFAS, there's DDT, paraquat, you name it, whatever, you know, comes out of our factories. There's heavy metals, leads, mercuries. And those they don't clean out. They kill the pathogens, typhoid.
Okay,
they don't clean out any of those heavy metals. So it would be better just to not add water.
Okay, I can see where your argument is heading, which is back to the time of my childhood when there were still many suburbs in the city of Sydney, where you dumped in a can and a man came on Thursday and took that can away and gave you a fresh can. Is this what you are really arguing for modern cities?
I'm so glad you have that, Dave.
No, we had it.
Human memory. But no, there's all kinds. I mean, now you can just go into a room that looks just like your toilet room, and you'll sit on something that looks just like your toilet, and you'll flush, and a little trickle of water will go through, and then it goes down to a composter. And the composters can be on the household level, they can be on the neighborhood level, they can be on the city level. You know, we have fantastic systems for composting toilets. It doesn't have to be a can with night soil workers coming around and picking it up.
Right. Now, look, let us end on a much higher note. I'm wondering, Kate, whether you would agree that the instinct to garden is something that is kind of almost deeper than the supply of food, that because human beings garden, the race survives.
We're definitely wired in an evolutionary way to garden, to put our hands in the soil. I think that's why, like, living soils, healthy soils smell so good and we're drawn to them.
Yes.
Some people even eat soils, and they usually do that when they have a nutritional deficit that they're trying to compensate for. And there's so many amazing things that happen when we put our hands in the soil. And, you know, and I dream about a day like in the city where I live, which is Boston, where instead of, you know, curbside parking, we had curbside allotment gardens. And, you know, I like to garden, and you're my neighbor, David, and say you don't like to garden. I'm like, that's fine. I'll garden both of our parking spots, former parking spots.
Yes.
And I'll give you whatever you want. And so one day you come out, and I'm pulling out some carrots out of the bed, and the carrots are so orange and delicious looking that, you know, you want them, and I hand them over to you. And even before, you know, you just brush off a little bit of the dirt, and you take a bite. And now something amazing has happened. And here's where our human evolution comes in. The microbes from the soil and the microbes from my hand, you've now ingested. And now we share more in common than just being neighbors. We have a biological connection. And microbiologists have found that humans that have that share microbiomes get along better. They come to agreement more readily. And that's what humans have done. We've come up with all kinds of strange practices. Like when we greet each other or we greet a stranger, we shake hands. Or in places like France, you might kiss each other on the cheek. Or in America, you'd give somebody a hug. And we invite them into our homes and we have a common bowl from which we share food. All of these practices, you go to a Catholic church and everybody drinks from the wine from the same chalice. Those are habits that we've picked up because somehow our ancestors, without microscopes, knew that to share microbes was to create community. And that's what we've lost in our modern world. We've retreated indoors. We're behind screens. We're communicating with people virtually through devices. And lots of people feel anxious and alienated and unhappy, disconnected. So gardens get us outside. They get us interacting in amazing ways with our environment and with the people around us.
And it's amazing the number of friends that somebody in a suburb can have as the fig season comes on.
Exactly.
We've seen it in our own lives. Friends sidling up and saying, your father-in-law's figs ripe yet? It's a great bonding exercise. Kate, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much, David, for having me on your show.
I've been talking to Kate Brown. She is the Distinguished Professor in the History of Science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but more to the point right now, the author of Tiny Gardens Everywhere, A History of Urban Resilience, published by Penguin. And that's the show. On our next, we celebrate the 250th birthday of those upstart United States by asking a couple of questions that need to be asked first. Why did they give Britain the boot? And let me tell you, it had nothing to do with the price of tea in Boston. And second, how did losing America spur the Brits to come to Australia? And there was a lot more going on, let me tell you, than finding somewhere to dump convicts.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.